From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The squads of skaters are set and the Zambonis are polished. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of the 2011 NHL All-Star Game and a profile of the league's leading rookie goal scorer, Jeff Skinner. Also, a report from the X Games in Colorado, an update on the Australian Open in Melbourne, and a service on the New Hampshire slopes. Also ahead, Marvel Comics legend Stan Lee discusses his new NHL-themed superheroes.
Well, a mascot is a mascot, but just by definition, a superhero is a superhero.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. While lots of people were still wondering how there could be an important men's final without either Roger Federer or Rafael Nadal, and a women's final without anyone named Williams, Li Na quietly became the first Chinese player to reach a Grand Slam final. Unhappily for her, Kim Clijsters also reached that final. She recovered from a first-set loss to beat Ms. Na early this morning Eastern Time. She won the tournament 3-6, 6-3, 6-3. Tomorrow, Andy Murray will attempt to become the first British man to win a Grand Slam singles title since Fred Perry managed to do that in 1936. All Murray will have to do is beat Novak Djokovic. The Serbian star has lost to Murray the last three times they've met. But Djokovic is the guy who knocked Roger Federer out of this tournament, so confidence shouldn't be a problem for him. Today's National Hockey League skills competition will include contests to determine the fastest player in the league, as well as who has the most accurate shot. Tomorrow afternoon, two pickup teams made up of guys who've never in their lives had to whimper, pick me, will go at each other in the All-Star Game. Joining me now from Raleigh, North Carolina, the site of that game, is LA Times hockey writer Helene Elliott. Hi, Helene.
Hello, Bill.
If you ask people on the street to name one National Hockey League player, it's a guy who's not going to be at the All-Star Game tomorrow. How much does Sidney Crosby's absence tarnish the affair?
I think Gary Bettman is weeping, frankly. I think they would have loved to have a Crosby versus Ovechkin kind of setup, because that seems to be the only players that matter in the NHL. Kind of like the Red Sox and the Yankees in ESPN's TV schedule. It seems like the NHL only wants to show the Capitals and the Penguins. So I think Commissioner Bettman is very unhappy that Mr. Crosby can't be here. But we'll soldier on with the rest of the stars of this league and with a new format. And we'll see how that goes.
Mr. Crosby's absence, of course, is due to his still recovering from a concussion. Is the NHL getting more aware of this problem as the National Football League is?
It has been, and there's a new rule that was put in kind of hastily last season, and it's supposed to minimize blindside hits. But I think what it comes down to, if you talk to players, is there's got to be respect among the players, and there really isn't. That said, Crosby's concussion was not caused by a dirty hit, but many of these hits are, and the league has become more aware of it. The league is out to punish them, but I think there has to be some discussion and some soul-searching among the players themselves and say, look, you're going to take out the guy next to you with a dirty hit. You're going to change his life. You're going to deprive him of his livelihood. I mean, who gains by this?
Helene, you spoke about a new format, and that, as I understand it, is basically these teams have been determined by the old pickup format that we all are familiar with via playground play.
Exactly. And you know, I give the NHL credit for trying something new, because the NHL All-Star Game has just become pretty much irrelevant, except to sponsors. You know, hockey, if there's no hitting, it's not a hockey game. And you're not going to get hitting in an All-Star game, except by accident. The game is really kind of lost a lot of its luster, unfortunately. And I give the league credit for trying something different. I'm not sure how it's going to work out, and I don't know that they will do it again next year, but I think this is kind of a testing ground, and I'm glad that they did it. I mean, they're trying to make the game relevant again, which is very difficult, and maybe this format works, maybe it doesn't, but at least they're trying something.
When you talk about the All-Star Game losing some of its luster, I wonder if that's partly because it comes just a month or so after the Winter Classic, the outdoor hockey game that they stage each year, which has become pretty popular.
Absolutely. I think that the outdoor game has become more of the showcase, focal point moment of the half season. The NHL has almost kind of killed its own All-Star Game by creating that. And, the Winter Classic is wonderful, and I covered the one in Wrigley Field, and it was just a terrific, terrific exercise. It was just a wonderful thing for the league to do. But the problem is just the very nature of it limits the number of places you can have it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have it in a warm weather climate. I mean, I guess you can try with these new refrigeration units and things that they have. And technically, they could probably do it in the Rose Bowl if they wanted to. But you laugh.
I just think hockey in the Rose Bowl is, what next?
It could be done. The refrigeration ice making guru says it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is sun coming down. They would need some kind of canopy over the ice to prevent it from melting from sun exposure, but they could probably do it if they really wanted to try very hard. And I think it'd be cool, with palm trees in the background instead of snow. I mean, come on. Have an open mind.
This is where I say they put a man on the moon. How come they can't play hockey in the Rose Bowl?
There you go. I like that.
All right, tell me about some of the players that you are looking forward to seeing in the skills competition today and in the All-Star game tomorrow.
Well, anytime you can watch Nicklas Lidström is a good day. I mean, the Red Wings defenseman is just the epitome of class, just an amazing hockey player, an amazing team captain, an amazing person in terms of just what he's been able to do for the Red Wings and help revive and keep that franchise's tradition going. And play at 40 years old at such an incredibly high skill level. I mean, I always love watching him. You know that the crowd here in Carolina is going to be really rooting for Eric Staal and for the rookie Jeff Skinner. And it's always fun when the players get together and they decide they're going to try and outdo each other. it's kind of a spontaneous thing. You can't really plan it. Some of them are showmen and the spirit will get to them, I'm sure.
Aline Elliott covers sports for the LA Times, and she's one of our all-stars here on Only a Game. She joined us from Raleigh, which is the site of the 2011 NHL All-Star Game. Thank you, Aline.
Thank you.
Replacing Sidney Crosby in this year's All-Star Game will be Jeff Skinner. The rookie plays for the Carolina Hurricanes and leads all first-year players in scoring, which is noteworthy because at 18 years old, Skinner is the youngest player in the National Hockey League. In fact, when he steps onto the ice this weekend, he will be the youngest player in any major professional sport ever to play in an All-Star Game. North Carolina Public Radio's Dave DeWitt has this profile.
Jeff Skinner comes around the corner of the Carolina Hurricanes locker room, eating an orange slice and looking for all the world like he's having a snack at halftime of a youth soccer game. In reality, about an hour ago, he scored a second period goal that helped beat the NHL's Tampa Bay Lightning in a key Southeastern Conference game. You can still hear the 20,000 or so fans roar their approval, even this deep in the bowels of the RBC Center. Skinner has already thrown off his sweater, skates, and pads. His appearance is striking, but not because he's a hulking professional athlete. He's not. He stands less than 6 feet tall and is generously listed at 193 pounds. Skinner is the youngest player in the NHL. He's 18 and looks about 15, but as everyone around him will tell you, he's not your average teenager.
Rangers take over again. Here's a chance. Skinner's alone. Skinner scores! Jeff Skinner with a beautiful move, and the Canes are up by one.
You would think Skinner has been preparing for these moments all his short life. But his dad, Andrew, says he wasn't a kid who was groomed for pro hockey from the beginning.
He wasn't one of these kids who actively dreamt about being in the NHL. And I think part of it was he was so busy with other sports.
One of those other sports was figure skating. Skinner was good enough to win a bronze medal at the 2004 Skate Canada Junior Nationals. But he decided to focus on hockey shortly after that, and at age 16 had a decision to make: play in Canada's top junior league or go a route that would take him to college. He chose the direction that would take him to the NHL the fastest. So he joined the Kitchener Rangers of the Ontario Hockey League and in 2 years became a junior league legend.
Loses the puck. Skinner! Skinner on a partial break! Skinner! Scores!
The Carolina Hurricanes took Skinner with the 7th pick in the amateur draft. Many predicted he wouldn't make the roster in his first year, but Skinner dominated the Canes' rookie camp, and he earned a seat in the locker room right next to the team's franchise player, Eric Staal.
I was the same when I came in as an 18-year-old. I sat right there. I've just moved over one, so I've been sitting there my whole career beside Rod Brindamore and Ron Francis. So now I'm the old guy, I guess, and I moved over one, and the new guy got to sit beside me. So, you know, it's fun. It's fun to have his energy and you know, try and give him little tidbits of information as he goes, but he seems to be doing all right by himself.
It's 8 hours before the Hurricanes play the Toronto Maple Leafs, Jeff Skinner's favorite team as a kid. He's racing around the rink during the morning skate, a mischievous smile on his face most of the time. Skinner and Paul Maurice, his coach, laugh often between drills. A few minutes later, in the locker room, Maurice has nothing but praise for his 18-year-old prodigy.
I mean, he's got most of the time doing everything with a smile on his face. This is a big thrill for him to be in the NHL. He's also got a pretty mean competitive streak in him. He wants to score. He barks at himself when he's not going. He'll protect himself a little bit on the ice. So we're really excited about the whole package, not just the fact that he puts the puck in the net or that he creates some offense for his line mates. This guy seems like the right kind of guy you hang on to for a long time.
The word mature comes up a lot when people describe Skinner. He may look like an adolescent, but when he opens his mouth, he sounds like he's been in this league for a long time.
I think the best thing you can do is just come in as prepared as you can, and that's what I think I did, and keep an open mind. I mean, obviously there's a bunch of great players in here that I can just sort of lean on for experiences that they've been through and learn a lot from them.
And you seem to smile a lot out there. Are you having fun?
Yeah, definitely. I think, anytime you get to wake up in the morning and play hockey as your job, it's a pretty cool experience.
When he first moved to Raleigh to begin the season, Jeff Skinner's parents came with him to help him get settled. But they went back home after a few days, leaving Jeff to navigate his way through 6'4" defenseman on the ice and the pitfalls of being a professional athlete off it. For the past few months, his dad Andrew has settled in front of the TV on game nights and, from almost 1,000 miles away, watched his teenage son play against grown men, some of whom have been in the league longer than Jeff has been alive.
I don't like to use the word surreal, but it is, it's odd to really describe, it's difficult to describe what really goes through your mind as a parent. We have a lot of confidence that Jeff's going to, you know, do well and do well by being an honest, hard worker and, you know, continuing to want to improve.
Andrew Skinner will be in Raleigh to watch his son Jeff play in his first All-Star game this weekend. It likely won't be his last. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Webb Chevrolet in Oak Lawn, Illinois, has staged promotions featuring the Chicago Bears. On Monday, John Stone, who used to sell cars there, wore a Green Bay Packers tie to work. He wanted to honor his late grandmother, who'd been a Packers fan. John Stone's boss, Jerry Roberts, ordered Stone to lose the Packers garb. Roberts would not comply, and he was fired. Very shortly thereafter, Mr. Roberts was hired to sell Chevrolets by a rival dealer, Guy Cesario, who said it's hard to believe anybody could be so stupid as to fire a good salesman for wearing a Packers tie. Mr. Cesario, who grew up on the White Sox side of Chicago, also said, "As a kid, I took a lot of abuse for wearing a Cubs uniform, so I've got some sympathy for him." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, skiers enjoy a pulpit in the powder. But first, Sean White, a.k.a. the Flying Tomato, a.k.a. Bloomberg Businessweek's second most influential athlete of 2010,
was eliminated from the men's snowboard slopestyle competition at the X Games yesterday afternoon. ESPN, home of the X Games for all of the competition's 15 years, could only comment, "Say what?" to the shocking development. But never fear, White will be back Sunday night in the final event of the competition, the Snowboard Superpipe Men's Final. Joining me now on the line from Colorado is Matt Higgins of the New York Times. Matt, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
White's rusty snowboard slopestyle skills didn't cut it in yesterday's elimination round. It was his first slopestyle competition in 2 years. But White did considerably better on Thursday night when he landed two back-to-back double cork 1080s, whatever they are, in the snowboard halfpipe eliminations. He got the top qualifying spot in Sunday night's final. Any reason to think that he won't finish on top in that event?
No, there's no reason to think that he won't. He showed that he's still in top form, and the competitive field really has been decimated by injury. Just before the preliminaries, Yuri Podlachikov, a rider from Switzerland who won the silver medal last year at the Winter X Games, injured his shoulder, and he won't be competing this year. Scotty Lego, who won the bronze medal at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver last year, broke his jaw earlier in the month and hasn't been able to train. Nevertheless, he still finished second in qualifying. And, of course, some of the other top riders were injured last season. Kevin Pierce most famously struck his head, suffered a traumatic brain injury, and then Danny Davis, another top American rider, broke his back and pelvis in an all-terrain vehicle accident. And he competed in the preliminaries on Thursday. It was his first event back, but he did not qualify for the final. So Sean White, as usual, on top.
Matt, you mentioned Kevin Pierce. These X Games have given you the opportunity to catch up with him. He's the 23-year-old snowboarder who suffered, as you said, a traumatic brain injury while practicing for the Vancouver Olympics a little more than a year ago. The last time I saw a profile of him, he was barely able to speak. How's he doing now?
He's doing very well. He looks strong and healthy, and he's very clear-headed. And I spoke with him on Thursday morning during the half pipe practice. We were at the bottom of the half pipe, and there was a lot of commotion. We were watching the competitors take their practice runs, and there was music blaring on the loudspeaker. And despite all of that, he was able to really focus and talk, I thought, very eloquently about his feelings. It's bittersweet for him. His recovery has been remarkable, and it's been really heartening for all of his fellow competitors. He's such a beloved person in snowboarding. He always had brought a really positive energy, and he was really one of the top competitors, one of the very few rivals to Sean White. But I think he's recognized that his return to snowboarding is still a long way off. His balance is not where it needs to be. He's doing really well, and that's encouraging. But at the same time, he's having to come to terms with the fact that he will never reach the stature that he had before.
I understand the Olympics are getting ready to add three more X Games sports. Tell me about ski slopestyle, ski halfpipe, and snowboard slopestyle. Boy, that's a mouthful, huh?
Yeah, it sure is. Slopestyle is contested in both snowboarding and skiing. It takes place on a downhill course with a number of obstacles, including jumps and handrails and picnic tables. And ski halfpipe is similar to snowboard halfpipe. It takes place on the same course. The skiers, though, are able to soar a little bit higher and spin more rotations. And it's very exciting. The whole free skiing movement has really been growing in popularity. And I think there's a recognition that ski halfpipe and ski slopestyle have the opportunity to lure a bigger and perhaps younger audience.
I'm curious about these offshoots as these sports develop sort of in new ways. Do these things happen because some kid up on the top of the mountain says, I wonder if I could get over that picnic table, turn around twice, and do a somersault on skis?
I think a lot of it you can trace back to, say, skateboarding. These are the types of maneuvers that skateboarders perform. They use the kind of natural urban terrain as obstacles, and it's grown organically in that way. These board sports, these so-called action sports, all kind of borrow from each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clear why the International Olympic Committee would covet the younger audience and, of course, the sponsorship opportunities that X Games sports bring to the Olympics. But do the athletes who got their start in the X Games want the Olympics as much as the Olympics want them?
I think so. I don't think you'd hear anyone in the free skiing community say that they don't want to participate in the Olympics. And I don't think you'd hear many people in snowboarding say that any longer. But the relationship between snowboarding and the Olympics has been difficult. Snowboarding went into the Olympics under the International Ski Federation control, and that rankled a lot of snowboarders. They all want to be in the Olympics. There's no question about that. They just want to have a seat at the table. They want to be able to say, this is how the sport should be judged. These are how the courses should be designed so that they can help progress the sport.
Matt Higgins covers action sports for the New York Times. Matt, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Bill. My pleasure.
Many a skier staring down a steep and narrow trail has said a prayer. But at New Hampshire's Loon Mountain Ski Area, there's one group of skiers for whom prayer is an integral part of the trip down the mountain. 2 weekends ago, Only a Game's Ron Schachter joined them, and he has the story.
There's no mistaking Loon Mountain's gondola lift for Jacob's Ladder. But every Sunday morning, just before 11 o'clock, it transports about 24 skiers on a more spiritual journey than usual. They're headed for the open-air dining terrace and scenic overlook next to Loon Summit Lodge. That's where Skip Schwartz, standing in a black robe draped over his ski parka, waits to greet them amidst the sounds of ski boots crunching snow.
Hi, and this is your first time?
This is my first time.
Congratulations. I admire your spunk and sense of adventure.
For the past 20 years, Schwartz, an ordained minister, has been offering what he calls downhill worship from just before Christmas right through Easter Sunday. His mountaintop congregation is a mix of regulars who own or rent ski homes nearby and first-timers, often with their children, who are just up for a ski weekend.
Sing to God, O kingdoms of the earth!
Ascribe power to God, majesty to the world.
Awesome is God and his
With the thermometer at a balmy 23 degrees and the sun-splashed white mountains and snowy stands of evergreens as a backdrop, Schwartz starts this non-denominational Christian service with a call to prayer and, after he straps on his guitar, with a song.
Oh, Lord, my God, when I in awesome wonder consider
But this interlude is just the first stop for these worshipers. Schwartz finishes with a quote from Matthew 4:21 before hopping onto his Atomic 160 skis, and then leads his flock, although they seem more in this setting like a herd of mountain goats, towards Bear Claw. That's a 2.5-mile novice-level slope reached via a shorter trail named, of all things, Exodus.
I didn't ski until after I started a ministry at a ski resort.
Before becoming a mountain Moses, Schwartz led a Methodist parish in rural Maine. But after conducting an Easter service atop Maine's Sugarloaf Ski Resort about 30 years ago, he had an epiphany on the way home.
As I was driving back down Route 27, I said to myself, my goodness, I said, that was a great experience. What are the churches in Maine doing for people in resort areas? And I said, somebody ought to do something for people at resorts like this.
There were already religious services available at Lake Tahoe, California, and a number of resorts in Colorado, but they all occurred in a single mountain location. Schwartz had a different idea.
In Colorado and California, they got church services on the slopes. You try to do that in the east, you're going to turn into a popsicle after 10 minutes. So you've got, I thought, in order to keep them for any length of time, you've got to move. So the idea of dividing a church service into three stops going down a ski trail came to my mind.
Today, barely a mile down Loon's Bear Claw, he stops on the right side of the trail in front of a snow-covered meadow elliptically ringed with evergreens. The adults balance on their skis while 4 or 5 kids recline next to the snowboards they've just kicked off as they listen to his sermon.
Thorns, yeah. Thorns. And what do the thorns represent?
Cares of the world.
Cares of the world, right. So the seed falls upon thorns, but the thorns choke it.
Schwartz says that he used to merge religion and skiing in his sermons, but nowadays he's careful about being too cute.
In the initial part, I would use metaphors like faith is like putting your weight on your downhill ski and stuff like that. But they grew old real fast.
Instead, he lets the natural backdrop do the talking.
Just there's something so special about being able to worship God in the outdoors, right in the midst of his created world, that lends itself very easily to worship.
Getting the word out isn't always that simple. At times, Schwartz has had to shout over the roar of snowmaking machines. And he recalls his shortest service for four diehards on one windy 10-degree below zero morning, a service that never left the summit gathering place. Over the years, thanks to his official garb, Schwartz has also been mistaken for a skiing judge, a minister presiding at a trailside burial, and by one very young skier, a giant bat.
And Father, we thank you that Roel Lavoie is out of the hospital, and we pray that her recovery will be complete and will be rapid. We thank you for Maria's cure from cancer, it's in remission, and we thank you for the wonderful cure of her father-in-law.
Maria is Maria Barrett from Lexington, Massachusetts. She recalls her first visit to downhill worship a year ago, just after her father-in-law suffered a catastrophic stroke and her cancer was diagnosed.
I tell you, the time that we were here the last time, it was cloudy, there was no sun, and all of a sudden we were all praying, and a stream of light came across over on the mountain over there. People were praying and caring, and I felt really, a lot of love and compassion and hope. I guess I was looking for hope, and there was definitely some hope, and that's what I needed.
The final stop of the 45-minute service comes at a big intersection about a mile from the bottom of Bear Claw. The skiers hear some final words from Schwartz and offer up individual thoughts and prayers, one of which was destined this Sunday 2 weeks ago to go unanswered.
And we pray for a Patriots victory.
And all of God's people said, amen. Amen.
Maria's daughter, 10-year-old Allie Barrett, is a weekly churchgoer back home in Massachusetts and appreciates the differences here.
Well, we usually are never on skis and not on a mountain. I like it a little better because you get to move around a lot, and I like the songs a lot too.
New Hampshire native Lisa Philbrick bought a condominium here 8 years ago because of Schwartz's ministry, winter and summer, when he conducts services at Loon's Summit. Philbrick's been downhill worshiping for 8 years and says it's a perfect combination.
You get to not only choose to glorify God, you also get to ski with your friends and your family. You can't ask for anything better than that, much better than going to church in town. It's an excellent idea. And if Loon were to ever choose to stop it, I would probably sell my condo and go somewhere else, because I think it's an important part of society that people forget.
Schwartz adds that he's also reaching skiers who might otherwise skip church on Sundays. Sue Sullivan doesn't fit into that category, and later at the Base Lodge says Schwartz's ministry is indispensable.
Well, what's important for me is that our whole family is still tied to our faith during the ski season. And I also feel like it's important for the kids to see, have their faith brought to them in many different ways, not just in a Catholic church, but also on a slope side. Or in the summer, he does it on the mountainside, you know, with a beautiful mountain backdrop behind him. And so that's what fills me.
Schwartz acknowledges that the management at other mountains might prefer the separation of church and skis. In fact, before he came to Loon, he was turned down by another ski area. But as far as his followers are concerned, Schwartz's unique downhill approach is preaching to the converted. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. In response to a recent story about bicycle polo, John Bush, who hears Only a Game on WEPR in Greenville, South Carolina, wrote, "I was transported to 1969 in a field in Aiken, South Carolina, where boys were riding fire engine red Schwinn bicycles and laughing in heated competition. Thank you so much for the delight you provided me." During last week's program, I spoke with Sports Illustrated writers David Epstein and Selena Roberts, who had collaborated on a story about the ongoing investigation of whether Lance Armstrong had instigated the use of performance-enhancing drugs among his cycling teammates, among other things. Cyclist Gene Dixon, who listens to the program on WUGA in Athens, Georgia, was not pleased. He wrote, "To me, even if guilty, Lance beat everyone because he was the best in the field using the same equipment as everybody else. If he's convicted of fraud, can I sue to get my money back for every baseball ticket I ever bought because the league wasn't diligent in doing their job? Of course not. There is only one icon in the sport of cycling. How about helping create some new ones? Do a positive story soon." Last week's program also included a story about kite skiing in New York. Terry Brunsman, who hears the program on WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, enjoyed that. "I especially liked the music button you used to finish the story," she wrote. "That song, Kites Are Fun, was a favorite of my dad's, and hearing it and singing along this morning brought back wonderful memories of him. Your show makes me laugh and think. My favorite combination." This week's email also provided evidence that some listeners are thinking ahead to next week's program, during which we will once again unleash the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players for another edition of Super Bowl Haiku. From Tim McCusker, who listens to the program on WRVO in Oswego, New York, comes this aquatically themed verse: "Longing for water, Green Bay, Monongahela, I dream of football." Another rather liquid haiku came from Daryl Desmond, a WBUR listener. "A hot bowl of soup, a frigid day, the big game, far from soup or bowl." You can register your comments in 17 syllables or more at the website onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Talent, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder, and this perhaps explains the recent presence on the television show China's Got Talent of a Shaolin monk who invited various people to kick him in the groin. Steel crotch kung fu, the ability to absorb such a blow and then smile warmly at the audience, can be either hard crotch kung fu or soft crotch kung fu, depending on various variables, just as well left unmentioned. When members of the audience in the China's Got Talent studio were caught crossing their legs as they watched the exhibition, they smiled wanly and claimed they were practicing crossed leg kung fu. Kung fu, I'm just trying to make. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Stan Lee, the creator of The Incredible Hulk and Spider-Man, lends his talents to the National Hockey League and discusses that heroic project with me. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Sidney Crosby will not be participating in the National Hockey League's All-Star Weekend, so are they going to have the game anyway?
It appears they're going to have the game anyway. This is one more alarming element to this story. If Sidney Crosby is taking his first steps down the road that leads to Eric Lindros land, the National Hockey League is really in for a bad time of it.
Jeff Fisher is no longer the head coach of the Tennessee Titans. 2010 was his 16th full season coaching the Titans, dating back to their days as the Houston Oilers. Some would argue that after 16 years and just one Super Bowl appearance, it's about time. How about you?
I wouldn't, because I think Jeff Fisher's a terrific coach. I think it was very smart of Tennessee to hang on to him through two rebuilding processes the way they did. The official argument is that he fought too hard to get his son on his staff. it seems to me like this was something that Tennessee wanted to do and couldn't find a graceful way to do it and finally did. He's going to wind up somewhere else. He's going to do fine. He's a terrific coach.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who makes about $10 million a year, announced this week that if there is a lockout, if the league locks out the players when the collective bargaining agreement expires in March, he will cut his salary to $1 a year. So that should solve the management labor problem, right?
Yes. Commissioner Goodell is just shocked that things have gotten to this position, doesn't understand how we could possibly be talking about the lockout that the owners have only been planning for 5 freaking years. Forgive me if I'm not too impressed by his offer. He'll be made whole once management wins, which it always does in the National Football League, and gets what it wants out of the players, and then Roger will get his money back. I am not impressed by his offer, no.
And beyond all that, I assume if your employer wanted to pay you $10 million this year, you would happily
work
for a dollar the next year.
I would work for a buck next year. I really would.
I'm sure that you've spent most of this week thinking about tomorrow's NFL Pro Bowl, I would like to refocus your gaze on the future. The Super Bowl is next weekend. Packers versus Steelers. We got a week more to think about it. How do those two teams match up?
I like it because I'm the guy who grew up watching the NFL in black and white on Sunday afternoons, and these are two legendary, historic, original, old-school NFL franchises. I think they should play outdoors. I think there should be a lot of mud, and I think they should bring Ray Scott back from the dead to do the play-by-play. I think it's as good a matchup as you could expect. I think you want an early line pick, I think the Packers are going to win.
When you go to the Super Bowl next week,
which I won't,
I know I won't either, but if you did, you could park your car just a tenth of a mile from Cowboys Stadium for $990. What if you bought that space and then showed up in a 1987 Volkswagen Beetle?
Here's the deal. If I'm paying $900 for parking space, I'm moving my car there and never moving it again. I'm going to get my money's worth. It's going up on blocks. I'm putting a DirecTV antenna on the roof. I may live in that car, in that parking space.
Charlie, football is a tough enough sport on the field. Players shouldn't have to worry about getting injured during the off-season workouts, but apparently the University of Iowa coaching staff doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, you've got 13 players hospitalized with the same unusual muscle disorder, which involves the breakdown of the muscles and the introduction of muscle fiber and muscle tissue into the bloodstream, which can cause liver damage, kidney damage. The best thing the University of Iowa has done is taken this out of the hands of the athletic department and handed it over to independent experts to investigate over the next 3 months. I would not want to be Kirk Ferentz when that report comes out.
If you give your favorite college football program millions of dollars, do you necessarily get to pick the team's coach? Because I understand that Robert G. Burton, who has given more than $7 million to the program at the University of Connecticut, does think that it works that way.
No, see, here's a tip for Mr. Burton, who may have gotten to this age in life without knowing this. Once you give something away, it's not yours anymore.
It's the old King Lear syndrome.
Exactly. Once you give it away, it doesn't belong to you anymore.
He wants the money back because he doesn't think they took his choice for next coach seriously enough.
They don't have to give you your money back. It's not your money anymore.
According to Forbes magazine, the Los Angeles Lakers are no longer the most valuable franchise in the NBA. They've been overtaken by the New York Knicks. I don't know if that's because the Knicks beat LeBron James the other night. Anyway, the value of the Knicks has risen 12% from $586 million to $655 million. I wonder how much it costs to park at a Knicks game.
Boy, that makes Amari Stoudemire the Hope Diamond of NBA free agents.
It sure does.
Just signing him, the value of your franchise went up 12%.
According to another business news source, BloombergBusinessWeek.com, Peyton Manning is the most powerful pro athlete in the United States. Okay, but were you as surprised as I was to learn that Shaun White was ranked number two?
See, I think Shaun White, I mean, if Peyton Manning were to disappear from football tomorrow, the NFL would go blithely on. If Shaun White were to disappear from the halfpipe tomorrow, except for a lot of really athletic dope smokers out there, nobody would know who was in the halfpipe. So I think Shaun White's power within his sport is much greater than Peyton Manning's.
Any of the other names on that list kind of leap out at you for one reason or another?
Well, Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson are ranked 3 and 4, but I think they're basically tied. Shaquille O'Neal is still ranked number 6. No sign of LeBron James in the top 20. No sign of Dwayne Wade. Nobody. And certainly no sign of Amari Stoudemire, who single-handedly improved the value of the Knicks 12%.
Lots of people have joked that NFL stands for the No Fun League because that league has outlawed such things as end zone dances. But based on how a display by Barcelona star Lionel Messi was handled by the Spanish Football Federation, you think the soccer authorities in Spain are perhaps challenging the NFL for the No Fun League title?
He was saying happy birthday to his mama.
That's it.
There's no reason why you can't say happy birthday to your mama.
He pulled up his shirt after he scored
a
goal.
And by the way, it was a penalty kick in a 3-0 game. It's not like it affected anything. Now, if he had written on his shirt, thank you, Qatar, for paying all those bribes, then he probably wouldn't got in trouble at all.
And finally, Charlie, there are many ways to make the case for your candidacy as an NBA All-Star. You can grab a lot of rebounds. You can score a lot of points. You can tell the fans via Twitter that you'd really appreciate their vote. But aroma doesn't usually factor into it unless you're Kevin Love of the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, this is very interesting. The Timberwolves Public Relations Department sent out a box of personal grooming products to the Western Conference coaches in an appeal to get Kevin Love, who really does belong in the All-Star game, by the way, named to the All-Star Ranch. I think Kevin Love's fragrance is pronounced numbers, but there's like a pound sign between the B and the R. So I'm not really sure how you pronounce this cologne he sent out. I think it's called numbers. They're going to try to get him in the game. And believe me, if you've been around basketball coaches in the middle of the season, cologne is a great idea.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among many other books, and he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Well, my late mother's birthday was in the summer, but I'd like to say happy birthday anyway.
And that'll cost you $400.
Deal. Maybe sometimes you oughta use a little more soap and water. By and large, I think you've made a sell. Oh, well, I love your smell. I love your smell. I love your smell. It's swell. I love your smell. I love your smell. I love your...
In hockey, it's useful to have a big, tough teammate who can help you settle the score when you've been wronged. But who backs up the big guys?
The most extraordinary superheroes ever assembled, the Guardians. Their powers know no equal. But are they enough to stop true evil?
Starting tomorrow, they can turn to a superhero. The NHL is set to unveil the Guardian Project as part of the league's All-Star Game festivities in Raleigh, North Carolina. The project features 30 new superheroes, one for each NHL team. And when you're looking to create new superheroes, you probably turn to Stan Lee, the man behind Spider-Man, the Hulk, the X-Men, and Iron Man, to name just a few. Stan Lee, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi there. Hey, it's good to be talking to you. As long as you ask nice, easy questions.
It's the only kind I know, Mr. Lee, I promise. Tell us how you became involved in the Guardian Project.
Well, it was brought to me. The suggestion came to me by some of the fellows who have been working on this for a long time. I thought it was a wonderful idea. It was such a big idea to create 30 superheroes, one representing each team. I had never done anything of that scope, of that scale, and it was a challenge, so away we went.
Well, the National Hockey League teams already have mascots, or at least most of them do. What are the benefits of having a superhero as well?
Well, a mascot is a mascot. But just by definition, a superhero is a superhero. And these superheroes are part of a team called the Guardians, which is really lucky for the Hockey League and for mankind in general.
I would think
so. Because we now have new protectors. And in fact, to tell you what a good job they're doing, you remember when the president made his State of the Union speech?
Certainly.
There were no untoward incidents, were there?
Aha! Uh-huh.
The Guardians were on duty.
Excellent. Not limited to hockey, these things.
No. It's their protectors of our world as we know it. But, of course, they are based on hockey teams, and each one of the heroes has a superpower mm-hmm. or a number of superpowers which have to do with the team he represents.
Well, some of these Guardians have already been revealed. Can you tell us, perhaps, which one is your favorite?
Oh, I have no favorites. I love them all. It's like asking a parent who's his favorite child. They are all so wonderful and so colorful and so exciting that Whichever one I'm looking at the moment, that's my favorite.
Now, since you've brought up this asking a parent to name a favorite child, I do have to mention for our listeners' benefit, none of these guardians look the least bit like children. They're all incredibly muscle-bound, gigantic creatures, right?
Well, if you wanted somebody to keep the world at peace and to take care of justice and liberty, wouldn't you want somebody who is fairly strong and powerful and able to do that?
Absolutely.
Of course.
The Guardians, as you have mentioned, all have various powers. One of the New York Rangers' powers is listed as, quote, narcoleptic confusion. And I'm very curious about what the Ranger can accomplish via narcoleptic confusion.
Well, if you can confuse your enemy, you're halfway toward victory right there, right?
Is hockey a favorite sport of yours?
I played hockey. See, I lived in New York, and there were very few ice rinks where I lived. So I used to play hockey in the street on roller skates with my friends, and we would have a guard at each end of the street to let us know if cars were coming.
Mm-hmm.
And if there were no cars coming, we hit that puck back and forth, and I loved it. But I've never played it on the ice, and I never played it when I got older, which is my loss.
You created some of the best-known comic book characters in history, Spider-Man, the X-Men, Iron Man, and others, and they all have special abilities, superhuman abilities, but which of your characters do you suppose would be the best athlete?
Oh, that's an interesting question. The best athlete? Well, I think Spider-Man would qualify because he is incredibly strong and nimble. I think Daredevil would qualify because even though he's blind, his other powers are so sharpened that he can do anything better than a sighted man. And if you could ever get the Hulk to calm down long enough, he might be pretty good.
Well, that would be the worry with the Hulk, that his temper would just get him in trouble with umpires and referees and officials every time, wouldn't it?
Yeah. If they drop the puck, he's apt to eat it. Hey, did you know I dropped the puck at a game here in L.A. a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah?
What a thrill that was. And then I rode around in the, what do you call that?
The Zamboni?
Car? The Zamboni.
Zamboni, yeah. Terrific.
They wouldn't let me drive it, though, which kind of bothered me a little, but I was a passenger. I can't wait till this all starts and I get to see a few games. I'm going to start becoming a big fan.
Excellent. How did you originally get into the comic book business?
By accident, really, I heard there was an opening in this publishing house, which was owned by the husband of a cousin of mine. And due to that relationship, I heard there was an opening. So I applied for the job. I was only about 17 or 18. And I found out it was in the comic book department because they also published other magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for a while. I even changed my name. I used to have a real name like Stanley Martin Lieber, you know, a real genuine name. But comic books in those days, comic books had so little respect that I changed my name to Stan Lee. I just cut my first name in half because I didn't want to use my comic book name for when I wrote the great American novel, which I've still never gotten around to writing.
Oh, I hope there's plenty of time left for that.
Yeah, I'll get to it sooner or later.
Mr. Lee, just one last question. You're working with the National Hockey League in the development of these Guardians, and I'm wondering if after the league finals this spring, is there any chance that they will award the champions the Stan Lee Cup instead of the Stanley Cup? I mean, it would just mean a kind of minor spelling change.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I hadn't thought of that. That would be very nice. And I'd be the guy who'd give it, so I could go to the games and present it to people. You sound like a guy who has a lot of influence. So seeing you brought that up.
I was going to compliment you on your terrific judgment until that last thing.
Bless your heart.
Stan Lee is the creator of Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, and many more. His latest superheroes, The Guardian Project, will be unveiled during the NHL All-Star Game telecast on Versus tomorrow. To see a sneak preview of some of the Guardians, visit our website, Mr. Lee, thank you very, very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you. And just think, someday people will be saying, Stan Lee, the co-creator of the Guardians, as well as Spider-Man and the Hulk and the X-Men and the Iron Man.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Golden Microphone Given and Doug the Orange Man Trabu. Our technical director is John Sonic Boom Parati. Our intern is Mark, potentially fabulous intern boy Filipino. Our senior producer is Gary the Credible Hulk Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Marvel Comics legend and NHL Guardians creator Stan Lee.
I hope the questions are easy because I know very little about hockey, about the teams themselves.
That's okay, Mr. Lee. Me neither. That's why we talked to Helene Elliott about hockey. We call her the Superwoman of the Slapshot. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. In the chill of the night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of a light, he arrives in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Well, the fame is ignored, action is his reward to him. Life is a great big bang up, whenever there's a hang up, you'll find
support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.